This is Indigo Radio, deepening understanding and making connections.
This is Nina out of Seattle for Indigo Radio. Indigo Radio is a project of the Spark Teacher Education Institute based out of Southern Vermont. We are a group of educators seeking to learn through engaging with others in our community and throughout the world. Find us at indigo.radio on Instagram or download a previous show on SoundCloud or Apple iTunes. Indigo is now broadcasting out of Southern Vermont, Western Massachusetts, Atlanta, Seattle, and Morocco. In a recent interview on Democracy Now!, director of Unseen, Seth Hernandez, quoted Ursula Le Guin, "Hard times are coming when we'll be wanting the voices of writers who can see alternatives to how we live now. We'll need writers who can remember freedom, poets, visionaries, realists of a larger reality." In today's episode of Indigo Radio, we invited Emily and Nora Khilfe, two Palestinian students. Emily is a graduate student of writing at Arizona State University, and she shares her poetry in our show today. Nora is a student at Edmonds College in Seattle. Both students share their experiences as Palestinian college students, their visits to their family home in Palestine, and poetry that speak truth to power.
As you prepare your breakfast, think of others. Do not forget to feed the pigeons. As you wage your wars, think of others. Do not forget those who fight for peace. As you pay your water bill, think of others, those who are nursed by clouds. As you return home to your home, think of others. Do not forget the people of the camps. As you sleep and count the stars, think of others, those who have nowhere to sleep. As you liberate yourself with metaphors, think of others, those who have lost their right to speak. As you think of others far away, think of yourself and say, if only I were a candle in the night.
This is for Palestine, of course, the capital, Jerusalem. Unarmed people marching to the wall when they're shooting them. Suppression is a question, resistance is the answer. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, of course, the capital, Jerusalem. Unarmed people marching to the wall when they're shooting them. Suppression is a question, resistance is the answer. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
All you see is war every time you turn your head at night. Bloodshed on the floor. Mother cries, who cries for this kindness? Truth between the...
So Emily, so I have Emily Khilfe and Nora Khilfe, who are sisters, going to two different colleges. And Emily, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, what you study?
Yeah, I am a master's student here at Arizona State University. I'm in the Master's of Fine Arts program studying poetry.
Great. And Nora?
I'm currently an undergraduate student at Edmonds College, and I'm undeclared in my major right now, but I'm planning on going into something anthropology related.
Great. And so understanding that identity is historical, could you tell me about what is your relationship to and what is your connection to Palestine?
Yeah, so our dad was born in Nablus, I believe, in Palestine, so in the West Bank. Our family originally comes from Jaffa, which is where Tel Aviv is now. Mm-hmm. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, they were part of the people who had to flee either during or before the Nakba, which was the catastrophe that happened in 46 times?
7 and 8, yep.
Yeah, and then they ended up in Nablus, mm-hmm. Which is where our house still is there, our family house.
Okay. And Nora, you had mentioned in class yesterday that you visited that house. Did you also visit that house, Emily?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the house and the visit.
It was really amazing. It's a really beautiful country. I think a lot of times people don't understand that it's in like the Levantine region. So it's like in the Mediterranean. So it means it's like gorgeous rolling hills, like olive trees, citrus. Like it's a very beautiful place. And it's also got just so much history. I think, you know, in the States, we think a lot about like, oh, Greece, I'll see like ancient Roman ruins and I'll see it in Italy or whatever. But there's tons of Roman ruins in Palestine and Jordan as well, where we also work.
Nora, do you want to tell a little bit about the story of visiting your family's house?
Yeah, me and Emily actually went in different years. Emily went with our brother TJ and I went with our sibling Elliot. So when I went, it was actually summer, so it was very warm. But our family house is in the valley and our family kind of lives on the side. So when you would stand out, we would spend a lot of time outside during the nighttime because that's like the coolest time of the days. And you would just stare out over like this view of houses and just rolling hills and lights. And it was just gorgeous. And a lot of fireworks during that time of year as well. And I just spent a lot of time just sitting out on our family's, our aunt's house. They live above my father's like family home. And so I would sit out on the balcony of my aunt's house and I'd be able to see where my dad grew up and I'd be able to see all of the like the entire like landscape of West Bank, and just it was just gorgeous.
I really love, you know, right now we're in a moment where we're hearing so much tragedy in Palestine, right? Not just Gaza, I mean this is since 1947, 48, but it's great to hear these human stories, I think. And I remember when I interviewed the Gaza Poet Society, it was a very similar, like, what is the daily life, right? What is it that you see? But I'm also curious, I know, you know, and I, of course, I've never been there, but I don't know what sort of the tensions and the differences of tensions between Gaza and the West Bank where you visited. Did you see any signs of occupation?
Yeah, definitely. I think the most marked signs of occupation that I saw was anytime you were trying to go anywhere. So getting in from Jordan into the West Bank, you have to go through the Israeli, like, I don't know if it was a checkpoint or just like a border. You have to pass through that. You see a ton of soldiers and like just the difference in how armed they are. Like they all had like AKs and the Palestinian side didn't have anything like that. When you were driving through the West Bank, there are separate roads for like Israelis can take and Palestinians can't go on them. There's different fees. There's different like license plates on the cars. So it's like truly an apartheid system. And that was very obvious. I think in Nablus, thankfully, I didn't see a lot, at least when I was there, but there's definitely a lot of like reminders because the second Intifada affected Nablus a lot. So there's still a lot of like ruin and like rubble from when that happened, even though that was like in 2000.
Yeah,
kind of time, and yeah. Just like the difficulty they have in like rebuilding, like it's just a limit. Like there's a limit of materials and access to the funds to like make these repairs. Also, sometimes they don't make repairs. They want to remember like the martyrs who died there. So there's also a lot of graffiti remembering people who had died.
Yeah. Nora, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I definitely had the same experience. Just a lot of soldiers, and even as being like they were like, you know, the segregated buses for when you're going through the checkpoint or the border or whatever, what like Emily was talking about. So me and my sibling were split up from our dad at that point. But even talking to foreigners, the Israeli soldiers were very like deadpan and like frank and like blunt with us. And it was really intimidating. And it was like scary knowing that they could probably like, if they heard our last name, they'd probably be able to clock that we weren't like the whitest of white Americans. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I knew I had that protection of having the American passport. So it's like the contradiction of being so vulnerable and so untouchable. And one of the other things that I don't know if it was going on when you went, Emily, but around the edge of the valley, like blocking all of around Nablus, they were building a road that was, I'm pretty sure it was Israel only. And so it's basically like, it was kind of like a gate almost around them of this road that kind of just looms over everything.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that didn't happen when I was going. But I actually just remembered I went during, there was a thing in Gaza, the March of Return that happened.
Yeah.
So when I went, it was a lot of violence happening in Gaza at that time too.
What year was that when you went?
It was 2019. 2018. Sorry, 2018.
Fairly recent. Okay. Yeah. Nora, when did you go?
Nora, you must have gone 2019. It was the year after, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe it must have been 2019 because I think it was around 16 at the time.
And okay. it was before the pandemic. So
I'm so curious, you know, what has been your experience being Palestinian here in the U.S.? Because as we know, I mean, the dominant narrative is anti-Palestinian and pro-Israeli. So I'm just curious, what has been your experience being Palestinian, being students, and just being in the U.S.?
I think it's changed kind of recently, actually. This is the first time in my life that I've noticed Americans even know what I'm talking about, which is nice. That's a really big change. I think even when Gaza was bombed in 2021, I just encountered a lot of people like not knowing, not caring, and or having a lot of questions. In undergrad, I was fairly lucky, I think. I think a lot of my classmates around me were very pro-Israel or didn't really understand, but I was very lucky I went to Pacific Lutheran University, and a lot of the faculty were very like educated and new. Mm-hmm. And so I was really lucky to get a lot of support from them. Actually, like Jane Wong, I think she teaches at Western right now. She's a poetry professor. She was like a fantastic mentor at the time. She was very supportive and able to give me an access to a lot of poetry, actually, that like really I could connect with, because she like knew like this is a student who doesn't have a lot of access to, you know, information or writers. They get fired, they get, you know, a lot of pushback. So I was very lucky with that. And I think also socially now at Arizona State University, a lot of my classmates really care a lot about a lot of like other social issues. Like we have a lot of Indigenous solidarity, a lot of like Latinx solidarity. There's just like trans solidarity. There's a lot of like groups, I think, especially in like MFA, thankfully, or like a lot of the art students too. There's just like a really strong sense of like how interconnected everyone is, which I feel like is a big difference from like in high school, even in undergrad. I think in the last like 3 years has been like a huge shift.
So that's good to hear. How's your experience been, Nora?
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that sort of shift that Emily's been talking about. I didn't really ever hear anything about Palestine talked around by my classmates or in school in general until I reached around college. My friends knew very well. I would talk about it and they would listen. They're all very supportive and very understanding. They would do their own like research and stuff. So it was good to have that sort of like close-knit circle of people who understood. When I went to Western, a lot of the students were very much like pre-Palestine, very supportive of it, very anti-Zionist, anti-apartheid. But the school was very much not, which was a really big dichotomy, because even a lot of the faculty would be very much like very much wanting to be vocal about what was happening. But as of recent, currently I'm attending Edmonds, but I have friends who are still attending Western, and one of my friends sent me the email that the head of the college, the headmaster, whatever his name is, he sent an email that was basically like, that basically said that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. That's what the email boiled down to. And everyone read it and went, but They have a very active, they have a club called Super, which is Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. And that club will do walkouts. They do protests in the Red Square, which is like the main area in the middle of the campus. And so there is a very vocal student community rallying for these rights for freeing Palestine, for ending the apartheid. So it really is just like the main school, like the heads of the school that are against it. In Edmonds, especially in the class that you teach, Nina, a lot of the students were very vocal about standing with Palestine, which was really comforting. I haven't really, a lot of my other professors don't really talk about it as much.
Right.
And in general, the classmates, but I haven't really heard anyone say anything explicitly like against Palestine recently. Then again, if people aren't speaking, you don't really know what they're thinking.
Right. And even in our class, I wonder, you know, if there are people who I don't know, who might not understand 100%. But that was actually the next question I was going to ask both of you, you know, is what has been sort of the institutional response? Because, you know, my friend Anna, who interviewed the student at Emory, this student wrote a letter to the institution who does not support anyone talking about these issues. And there have been other, like, California higher ed plus K through 12. I think there was a case, I think it was in Northern California, where this organization was pro-Zionist is asking teachers for their text messages, for their emails, and any mention of Israel, Palestine, I think they may get into trouble. So they're institutionally, I don't know of any institution, I haven't heard of any institution that's been supportive. So I'm just curious what your experiences have been. And Nora, you just mentioned, you know, Western Washington University sent an email out about that. I don't know, Emily, what's been your experience?
Yeah, so ASU, I would say, unsurprisingly, has been very biased towards Israel, for sure. I think their first statement they put out, they were like, we condemn terrorist attacks by Hamas against Israel, and that was kind of the end of it.
Yeah.
And they've been fairly retaliatory towards, like, student groups that have protested, or you know, any smaller groups like the clubs that will speak out against it, they'll kind of get targeted again for being like hate speech or whatever. But it's always like the, you know, the minority students who are speaking out are the ones who are getting in trouble for speaking out.
Yeah.
Because they're also like the least protected, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And so on an institution level, like, even our literature magazine was told, like, you can't say anything about it.
Wow. Okay.
But I would say, like, within the departments too, there's kind of been a, because it's not just like the whole college, is kind of the larger architecture of the different departments or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's also been a huge variety. Like, I would say my department has been great, but then some of the art students have told me that their department's responses have been terrible. And so it's been, I think the biggest point of frustration for me with ASU's response has just been that they're like, we don't condone hate speech. We believe everyone has the right to say whatever, but we can't withstand whatever. But then they'll let groups like Turning Point, which is an extremely staunchly like right-leaning group, come and talk on campus, and they'll be like, well, free speech, everyone can say anything. It's like, well, you got mad that people protested for Palestine, but you can let Turning Point come on campus. So there's a lot of that, like, everyone deserves the right to speak, but not if you are protesting for human rights. So
right. So that great pointing out that contradiction, yeah. And so for us, all of us, right, to think about, what's the purpose? Why do we have these contradictions? But I wonder, Emily, if you'd like to share a poem with us. When I say us, I mean anyone listening to this podcast, students, educators, activists, organizers.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'll actually read the poem. I wrote one about Oppenheimer, actually way before the movie. But I think a lot about atomic power when it comes to issues of, like, power and freedom, which I think is relevant to Palestine, since they're occupied by a nuclear power and have no nuclear power of their own.
Yeah.
So this is called Oppenheimer Cradles the Bomb, and I'm supposed to feel sorry for him. Sucrose, vermilion, the bloom, the stem. The atomic fact is we are all big things made up of smaller things, belted in Bible and rust. In biology class, we watch Oppie catch the falling core. He is poisoned and he dies. This genocide justice, this eye for that eye. Lick of blue light, molecules in cellophane, unwrapped and unsinned. Some might say ungospeled. Some might say, what have we done? What we have done is godlike and Gomorrah'd, heart unbuttoned and torn from the sleeve. That thick American cruelty, hot and silver against our pink, gloveless hands. The atomic fact is we are all small things made up of bigger things, a singular event swaying in a plain room.
Wow. That's powerful. I liked the last few lines about the heart and the hand and the silver. it builds up to that sort of like, you know, and how we are just really, as humans, very small in a big universe. Why did you write that poem, Emily?
I think I was really struck by the ways we are taught to think about war, I think, in a lot of ways. Like, I remember, this is based on, we watched a movie, I want to say it was called Fat Man and Little Boy. Like, I think that was the name of it. It was about the, you know, the creation of the atomic bomb.
Yeah, which they named Fat Boy. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I remember in the movie, I don't actually know if it was Oppenheimer, the character, but there's a guy who like touched the core, and the whole thing was about this tragedy about him like getting poisoned by the thing he created. But I was like, if you're creating an atomic weapon, like, you're going to be poisoned by it. And so I thought a lot about like the politic of sympathy and this idea of like, we're supposed to be sympathetic to this person who creates the bomb. But I thought a lot about like, what about everyone else? What about the people who are not only the people who are affected by the bomb itself dropping, but everyone around it, like the poisoned, all the communities poisoned by it. And, you know, historically they've been like indigenous populations poisoned by the atomic waste. So thinking about like the shifting that politic of sympathy.
Wow, that's great. And Nora, you're the one, you talked about it in class. What's your reaction to this poem? It must have impacted you since you brought it up.
Honestly, all of Emily's poems are really impactful to me. I just love her poetry a lot. And some of the imagery in it, I feel like there's like a certain level of understanding in some of her poems where she'll talk about things like about growing up in our family. That's like, it feels very personal because it's kind of only experience you get growing up with the same parents, with the same siblings in the same house, with these sort of connections. I thought this poem was really impactful because of like the imagery used and like sort of the lines like, what have we done, followed by what we have done, is like sort of this sort of like when there are people who do those sort of levels of catastrophic creation and something goes out of hand, they're always the sort of like, how could this have ever have happened? And it's like, you know what you were doing going into this. You went in wanting to create these things of mass destruction. And then when it decides to destroy you too, suddenly you're surprised.
And I love how you brought up the politic of sympathy, because as you said at the beginning, it really applies, right? Who are we sympathetic towards and who do we ignore? And I mean, historically, right? I mean, I will flat out say the United States is an imperialist nation. And so what, you know, these narratives about Oppenheimer or, you know, any of the narratives that we learn, at least, you know, those who of us who grow up here, completely erase Palestinians, it erases Vietnamese people, it erases Iraqis. So I think that's really powerful and an important thing to think about. And as we teach too, you know, and we talk to people, and to humanize people.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think something that's so interesting to me and something I try really hard with my work and even thinking about the people I spend a lot of time with in class, which I think they're also in the same boat as me, but thinking about like who is not being looked at? Like, who are we not hearing from? Like, who does this narrative ignore? And who does that serve?
These are excellent questions, Emily. So if there are educators who are listening, you know, hopefully they'll pick this up and bring it into their classrooms. But what I'm curious, what drew you to becoming a writer? I don't know if you write just poetry or if you also write short stories or novels.
Yeah, I actually originally started with writing fiction. I have been a huge reader. I think I've wanted to be a writer since like first grade. Like, I've just always loved it. I don't really know if there's like a why. I think sometimes people just have something that they just love to do. But I started with fiction mostly because I just really love characters and people and story, which I think is just kind of like human nature. But when I got to college, again, I was very lucky to take a poetry class with Jane Wong. And she was able to really show what poetry could do to represent people who you really don't hear from. So I read a lot of like Iranian American poets or Chinese American poets or just like a wide variety of voices who I like didn't know were getting published, you know, like I had no clue because I would Google like, you know, Palestinian American poets and it would be Naomi Shihab Nye and that was it.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. And so, which I love her work. She's great. Yeah, but it, it really was like, there's only one, like, that's it.
Right.
And I think talking to, you know, getting to know my mentors was really being part of like a connected world where there is like a large like bloom or like emergence of a lot of Palestinian writers. Not even emergence, I think they've always been there, but like the censorship has really kind of started to deteriorate, which it's still happening, but.
Yeah. And you brought up Iranian, you know, I think a lot of Iranian artists and writers are also pretty demonized and censored in this country.
Yes, very much so, yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else? Are there any other poems that you'd like to share?
Yes, I do have one more. Let me grab it. Okay, this one I wrote, it's sort of randomly from like a prompt my friend gave me about supply chain issues. It's not related to that at all. The original prompt was supply chain issues with the blood of Christ, but it's not related to that in any way. Now it's called Al-Azariya, which is a town in Palestine that's named after, it's called like Place of Lazarus. Lazarus. Okay, this is Al-Azariya. What the Romans failed to understand, it's not enough to be dead. God plucked me like a string and sheared the melody. Your miracle, your very own mechanical Turk. First egg, then sphere, then hen, poor empty hen. When I emerged like a whisper, the whole world strained to listen. God claimed my land the way a pilot claims his crash site. No, it's not enough to be dead. My olive blood, my short wave radio, my tomb. I'm all bruised with holiness. Your want a thumbprint in my pear flesh. I admit it. I love that I deny you. An apricot harvest with no apricots. My dimpled flesh soiled and rotted. See here, my burial clothes, my headcloth, my pitless eyes. You can dress up in my effigy, but you'll only ever be my ghost. I love that what you steal still belongs to me. Even your shovel thirsts for my grave.
Wow. I was just writing down this really impactful lines and then it's like in chicken scratch writing. But I was like, oh my gosh, what beautiful imagery. Of course, like I'm thinking, my brain is like, oh, what does this mean in the context of now, and pitless eyes, and the beast, you said God something by, oh, I can't read my writing. My gosh, I'm like, but wow, what a beautiful poem. Very meaningful. What does it mean to you, this poem?
Yeah, so I really wrote this one after hearing about, it's kind of, to put it very bluntly, about cultural appropriation. I think I wrote it after I heard, it was around the time that there were like 5 mass graves that were discovered like on a beach in Israel. And I remember being very disturbed by this idea of like people having like their holidays on these mass graves, basically. And just thinking about what it means for like people to be so desperate to appropriate your culture that like still belongs to you, that you're still alive to own. And this kind of like denial of like, you might try to steal these things from me, but you literally can't because it always is mine.
Right.
And this like refusal to be part of this narrative. I think a lot of it is that the refusal, rejection of like, you know, you can dress up in my effigy, but you'll only ever be my ghost.
Right.
It's this idea of like, you can dress up to look like me, but you can never be me.
Right. Right. Wow. Really beautiful. Nora, any reaction?
Yeah, honestly, it's another beautiful poem. Like, what can I say? But yeah, that line, the one that you just quoted, you can trust my empathy, but you'll always be, always be my ghost, or however that line goes. That's the one that really stood out to me, because it's like this like concept of trying to like, it is that really the concept of trying to take something that isn't yours. Mm-hmm. It's like, it'll never be yours no matter how hard you try to claim it is. And it's like, you'll only ever be like a shadow of what I am.
What's so great, I think, about your poetry, Emily, is that they're political. And I'm, my assumption, and this is again my assumption, and you can correct me, is that you can't help but be political because of who you are, and the history, you know, your own history. But tell me a little bit about, you know, what drives your poetry.
Yeah, I'd say you're totally correct that, I mean, if you mention Palestine in the States, like, you're just inherently political, whether or not you want to be, just existence political in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I think what really drives my poetry is, I think, first of all, a desire to just speak about Palestine at all, just because censorship is so, like, mm-hmm. pertinent. And I think a lot of the times, like, the work of my poetry is never to convince somebody of my humanity, but it's to give them the opportunity to know that a person is speaking, and like, it's up to them to accept it or reject it. But I think a lot more people do accept it. I think that just seeing how the tides have turned, like, I think that kind of goes for itself. People are prepared to understand, and I think that's why censorship is so, like, so deep and so strong. Is like, if it didn't matter if I spoke, then there would be no reason to censor my work,
right?
You know,
do you feel that your work is censored in some ways?
I don't. That's the difficult thing. I don't know. I think I'm honestly probably the luckiest generation of Palestinian writers. I know that there are organizations that are Zionist, so I oftentimes select out of, you know, submitting to them. I thought about it a lot, actually, honestly, when I was applying to grad school. I never knew, like, if I would get rejected because they didn't. If they were Zionists, like, I didn't know if that was the reason why I would get rejection or not. So that's also, like, something I had to consider a lot when applying, is, like, does this faculty seem like they will understand what I'm talking about? Right. Does this faculty, are they in an institution that's done anything pro-Palestine? There was a lot of, like, extra research. So that's something I've definitely thought. Like, it's hard to know, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But I know a lot of my fellow poets have kind of experience the same kind of question, or have been like, a new thing that's happening is you'll be used for kind of like the diversity, and like used as like a, see, we're cool, but then the institution itself does something totally opposite.
Yeah.
And that's been a big thing that's going on in the poetry world right now, which a lot of people have like pulled their work or have like spoken out against like specific presses and publishers because of it. So.
Right. Wow. Well, is there anything else you'd like to share before we close out?
Let's see. Let me share one from when I visited Palestine.
Oh, awesome. What a treat.
Let me see. Nora, do you have any favorites? Oh, my God. Shout out to Nora. Let's ask Nora.
Oh, my gosh. I'm trying to think of what it's titled. I really like Kiss and Mystique. That one's really pretty.
Oh, my God. I was going to grab that one. Perfect.
Great.
Okay, so this one is written a lot about when I visited Palestine, but also it's based on an ekphrastic work, so it's a poem written after or for a painting, so it's for a work by a writer, or no, not a writer, a painter, Suha Shoman, whose painting is called Chance and Mystique.
Mm.
Okay, so this is Chance and Mystique. Nothing lost stays gone forever. Like a storm cloud wavering over Mount Ebal, thin to the sky as a dove in the watchtower's eye. I ate an escadenia, and I became soft-plumed and dented as a hill's hide, daughter to nothing but milk and music. This is no god, not in my sand cradle, not in my land if the land stays stolen. say missing, say mystic, say miracle maker or mother, cloud dust or even better, oil and za'atar, how names can change a thing. I ate a loquat while angels dipped their heads and listened, hummed along. No lyrics to this too big something, brazened with the breaking of rain. Not broken, no. And I take back what I said before. Here sits holiness of sorts. Here sits coral, blood, and cherry. Here scatters the stars like my uncle scatters saplings. I saw a storm arrive in Kansas, and nature stalled to listen. Fireflies dizzy with song. I saw dead flies flecked in cherry juice in Jerusalem, and it folded me reverent and shattered. My uncle handed me a map with cities and names lost to red signs and treaties. Well, you are, change is a thing. All right, so the map is illegal. All right, so it's hidden and gone. I carry that vision with me like a passport, like a stolen diamond, like my little sister's glove.
So Nora, why do you like this poem that you selected it?
I really like the ending part where it's, but the line, what you are changes a thing. And the lines about the uncle with the map and all those missing places. I also really like the dichotomy between the imagery of Palestine and then the line about Kansas. So it kind of has that feeling of like being split between the worlds of America and Palestine.
Right.
And those feelings of being born so recently, because I was only born in 2004, so I feel like there are all these like memories and places and things that I will never get to see or touch or really know. And the only way that I get to see these things and feel that world is through my uncles and aunts and my dad and my cousins telling me about them.
Yeah, it reminds, you know, remembering our histories is so critical to who we are, as you said. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been really amazing for me. What a treat to hear poetry from an amazing poet. And, you know, your sister, Nora, I had the pleasure of working with for a whole quarter and hearing her thoughts.
أي وهيك عم تحكي مع الناس العنف عندهم مقدس وين ما روح بضل محبوس في هذا القفص ولا نفس هاي كمان واحد القتل هاي كمان واحد الحبس كمان واحد الخلع لبس شو اللي عم بيصير ما في تفسير مش شايف غير مصير للدموع ممنوع اعمل اللي بدي اياه لازم انسى الحياة بتمنى بس لازم ازبل انت الدنيا كلها صارت عنا ماذا استطيع صعب اكتب من كتر ما في مواضيع عم بضيع فكرته عن السلام بيعمل اللي بده اياه انت ضل كله كل شي تمام عشو عم بشكي جبالي يطلع عمل غير اشي بدل ما طلعت هون حاس حالي ضعيف خليني اطلع برا اعمل اشي تسجل في التاريخ مانا هيك يا مقتول يا جريح رخصة السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فقدت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق أمنيتك رخصة السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فكرت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق أمنيتك انصرعنا من أرضنا بلدنا انغلبنا عحالين قلبنا